We've got mail. It's our first open mailbag segment here on the podcast, so let's take a closer look.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's that time again, another episode of the Council of Trent, and this is a first time for us. It's our first open mailbag segment. This podcast, I want to really practically help people explain and defend the Catholic faith, to be able to answer objections to it. And so I want to do that and meet the needs of where all our listeners are coming from, and you all know what you really need to hear about. So what I'm excited about is that subscribers to our podcast, as a special gift to them for making the podcast possible, I'll be answering questions that you submit. So every now and then I'll be making a post on our Patreon page asking for questions for the podcast, and you all faithfully chimed in. We've got a lot of great questions, and if you'd like a question you want publicly answered in a podcast, become a subscriber, a gold level member or higher, and you'll be able to do that because I'll be doing these open mailbag segments periodically. And you guys give me a lot of great questions, so I'm happy to do more of them. So why don't we jump right in and look at some of the questions we got from our subscribers. I'll be naming each one. And before we start, thank you again for supporting the Council of Trent. So our first question comes from Nathan. Nathan writes, how to talk to a nihilist, wants help with nihilism. I work with someone who I challenge by saying he leads his life assuming human life has value, but intellectually he denies that they have value and he is inconsistent. So how do you talk to a nihilist? So as you probably guessed, nihilism is a philosophical worldview that says ultimately nothing matters. There is no ultimate sources of value. You might think nihilists, why don't they all just commit suicide? And I think for many of them, they'll say, well, at least I enjoy life, at least for now. And so if I'm enjoying it, I might as well keep enjoying it. There's no need for me to leave. It's kind of like if you're watching television, there's some movies you wouldn't start, but if you happen to stumble upon it, you might as well finish it. I think that's kind of how nihilists view life, is kind of a mediocre cable television movie that, well, I might as well finish it since I'm here anyways. So how to talk to a nihilist, someone who denies that human life has value? Well, it is hard. I'm going to give you that, Nathan. And it's interesting here, you're right, that people will say, you know, intellectually, oh, I'm a nihilist, I don't think anything matters. But then they don't act that way. They don't live that way. They become outraged or angry, usually, when they hear about horrific injustices committed against other people or committed against people that they may never meet. And yet I'd say, well, you have no basis to be outraged by that because you think ultimately nothing matters. If there's no good values that matter that we should strive for, then why bother avoiding the bad ones? Why be outraged by anything if it doesn't personally affect you? I'd also put them on the defensive and ask them for an explanation that many people, even many atheists, will say life does have value, life does have meaning. So for the nihilists, I'd say, well, what argument do you have against this common sense view that life has value? If he says, well, you prove it has value, I'll say, well, it's just self-evident. It just appears that human beings matter more than animals, what we do is important, and that we have moral duties to one another, and there are things that we should consider to be important and unimportant. That is as self-evident as the fact that the external world exists. I mean, there are people who think the world is an illusion. There are people who think the world might be a computer simulation. Well, you prove it's real and that it's not a simulation. Well, I don't have to. It appears real. There's no reason for me to think otherwise. So you got to give me a reason to think that what appears to be the case actually isn't. So if you say that there is no ultimate value, nothing really matters, most people think it does, and that seems self-evident. What's your positive reason to make me think otherwise? And make sure to put them on the defensive in that regard. So I hope that that's helpful. Next question comes from Andrew. Andrew writes, how do you explain to non-denominational Christians about sola scriptura? I have a friend who doesn't believe in the need to have seminaries to teach formalized doctrines. Instead, he believes in just reading scripture and interpreting it. Now, we could talk about sola scriptura, and we certainly will on many, many podcast episodes. It's one of the big dividers between Catholics and Protestants. But it's interesting you have people who will say, well, I don't need to go to seminary. I don't need a church to tell me what to believe. I'll just read the Bible and interpret it. How do you respond to someone who says that? Well, I'd ask them, number one, where does the Bible say we should do that? And does it say the opposite? Go to 2 Peter 1:20, which says this: first of all, you must understand this, that no prophecy of Scripture is a matter of one's own interpretation. So it's people, also go to 2 Peter 3:16. St. Peter makes this very clear. 2 Peter 3:16, he says, there are things in St. Paul's letters that the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction. So one, Scripture doesn't tell us to only read Scripture. And two, it tells us how prophecies don't come from our own interpretation, that people who try to read Scripture on their own twist it to their own destruction. And I'd also quote 2 Timothy 2:2, which says this: what you have heard from me before many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. So St. Paul's telling St. Timothy, not, hey, hand them my letters, they'll read it, they'll figure it out. No, he's saying, take my teaching and you teach it to them and they'll teach it to other people. That the Bible never says our only rule of faith is going to be a book, a collection of writings, and that we should adhere to those collection of writings and just pass on those collection of writings. It just doesn't say that. In fact, I would ask this person, okay, so just read Scripture and I just interpret it. That's it. If I read Scripture and I interpret it that Jesus is not God, which is what the Jehovah's Witnesses do when they read Scripture, then what am I supposed to do with that? You said just to read Scripture. Oh, well, they're wrong. Oh, so it sounds like it would have been really great if these Jehovah's Witnesses were taught a kind of formalized doctrine, like maybe the deity of Christ, so they wouldn't go astray when they're interpreting Scripture. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, just read Scripture and interpret it, but oh, by the way, you should believe in the Trinity, the deity of Christ, salvation by faith alone. What if I read Scripture and I interpret it and I decide to become a Catholic? Many people have done that. I did that. So you can't have it both ways. That those people who say, well, you just need the Bible, that's it, they believe in other traditions that have been handed down as well for interpreting Scripture. So no one is ever truly by Scripture alone or sola scriptura. They still believe in some kind of tradition handed on to them. The next one is from a longtime fan of Catholic Answers, Margot. Margot writes, how do you explain natural law outside of religion? I'm in a discussion with an atheist. He wants to know where I get my objective truth from. Well, I'd say we get objective truth about morality and how we should live from two different sources. One would come from revelation. God tells us in his word how we should treat one another, how we should worship him, how we should act. And that's a way of God just bluntly telling us in Scripture. Here it is in black and white. Here's the Ten Commandments. But people knew about the morality of the Ten Commandments before the Ten Commandments. People knew about that. People knew murder was wrong. The reason God reveals morality is sometimes we just need it pointed out bluntly and clearly for us when we try to rationalize it away. So that's one reason is revelation, but as I alluded to, reason. We can reason our way to moral truths, that if we just sit and reflect about human beings and what makes a good human being instead of a bad human being, we can know by reason humans ought to behave in a certain way towards one another. We have rational faculties to do good and to avoid evil, that if we can see a good tree is one that flowers and is not all barren and with dead sticks, and a good dog is one with four legs that runs and can do tricks and performs those functions, then we could say, you ask this person, what's a good human being? What makes a human being good? And they're going to use reason to follow a law or a way of acting that is natural in the sense it's built in our human nature. Natural law doesn't mean laws of nature like the laws of gravity. It doesn't mean what happens in the natural world. Natural law means you can look at someone's nature, who they are, what they are, and determine from that how they ought to act. So if you look at human beings with hands and feet, rational minds, reproductive organs, we can see they're ordered towards certain ends, that you don't put your hand in a blender, you don't put your hand around someone's throat to strangle the life out of them, use your hands to build tools to help others. We can look and just see human dignity is self-evident and see there are ways we ought to act. And Margot, I'd recommend if this person says, where do you get your morality from? You know, what's this natural law? Ask them, look, how do we know if society's laws are right or wrong? A good condensation of natural law can be found in Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. He says, look, segregation, racial segregation laws are wrong. And it doesn't matter if human laws, if human beings think they're right, they contradict the natural law written into our being, which he says is a subset of the eternal law of God. So God is his eternal law, but even if you don't believe in God, you can use the mind God gave you to think about, well, how should I act? How should society function? That if society has gone astray, a reformer will say, wait, this is not the way. The laws we have don't conform to the natural law written into our natures as human being. A good book I'd also recommend on this subject would be Charles Rice and his book, 50 Questions About the Natural Law. I think that should be very helpful for you, and thank you so much for your support of Catholic Answers. Laura asks, how do you explain unanswered prayers? You pray for something and trust that the Lord will meet your needs, yet when you what you want doesn't happen, how do you continue to have faith? That's a good question. I think it's hard for a lot of people to pray for a certain end, and then it doesn't happen. We say, well, where was God? He didn't answer my prayer. And this is a hard truth we learn, but I think it's an important one. God always answers our prayers. It's just sometimes the answer is no. But why would the answer be no? If you look back in the Old Testament, there's a great verse in the Old Testament where God says, I have plans for you to prosper, not to suffer. Now, sometimes there's suffering along the way, but our ultimate goal in life, remember, our ultimate goal is to get to heaven and spend eternity with God. And there may be a lot of bumps along the way in this life, including bumps all the way to the end. But all these things lead us closer to God, that it's hard when God lets us suffer or keeps a good thing from happening to us. We say, well, why are you doing this? We have to remember, in our position, we do not have the eternal foresight of God. We do not have God's omnipotence. For us to say God is making a bad call, that's like standing 1 inch away from the Mona Lisa and saying it's a bad painting. We can't see the big picture. And you know, I mean, I say this now calmly, but when things don't go my way, I get mad at God. It's hard. But I have to say, you know what? God knows what he's doing. And maybe he's letting there be a trial in my life for me to grow closer to him. Maybe a trial for me to learn how to suffer better, to offer up my sufferings, to accrue grace for other people. Who knows? But I'll still do my best to bless God and ask him to help me endure these trials for whatever plan he has for me. And I've had this. I remember once praying for a job I really wanted and I didn't get it. And why did God not let this happen? And then a year later, I was offered a much better job that set into sequence a series of events for me to become an apologist at Catholic Answers. So, Laura, I understand, and I would just say, look, if your prayers aren't answered, just be honest with God and say, God, I'm really struggling here. This is really hard. Help me to continue to trust in you, and I'm just going to pour out this hard thing I'm dealing with. I'm going to give it back to you since you gave it to me, but in doing so, I'm not going to stop trusting you. So keep praying, and just remember, our prayers, he doesn't always say yes. If he says no, he's doing it for something for our good, at least for our eternal good. So do keep that in mind. Rachel Russell in Perth, Australia writes, hi Trent, great podcast. My question is about a religion called Iglesia Ni Cristo. They are everywhere here in Perth. Can you give me advice on how to best approach their ministers and resources that can help me? Yeah, Iglesia Ni Cristo, I basically call them the Jehovah's Witnesses of the East, of Southeast Asia, really. They're very similar to Jehovah's Witnesses. They believe they are the Christ True Church reestablished, and they deny the Trinity, they deny the deity of Christ. So they have a few other interesting things they believe, but that's their main thing. They deny central Christian doctrine, so they're not a Christian group. They're like Jehovah's Witnesses in that regard. So how to engage them? I would engage them in the same way I engage Jehovah's Witnesses. You can certainly respond to their arguments against the deity of Christ, and we have great resources for that at Catholic.com. And an article just on Iglesia Ni Cristo so you know more about where they came from. So you can respond to them, but I would challenge them on their question of authority. They were founded, I think, in like 1914 by Felix Manalo, and he claimed to like be God's prophet, reestablishing Christ's church. I would ask them, look, where's your evidence for this? You say you're Christ's church? Okay, where's your evidence? You got to have a miracle. Do you have some kind of proof? I mean, the Catholic Church has been around for 2,000 years. They got a historical pedigree. What makes you think this Felix Manalo guy was right and this really is Christ's true church? where's your evidence? And they don't have any. And the evidence they do come up with is really poor evidence. They'll say that they were prophesied in Isaiah 43, 5 through 6, because God says in there, "Fear not, I'm with you. From the far east, I will bring your offspring." And they say, "Well, we're from the Philippines. That's the far east. It's talking about us." One, even if it said that, there's lots of stuff in the far east. It's not necessarily talking about you. Two, in both the Philippine translation, the Tagalog translation and the Hebrew, Isaiah 43:5 does not say from the far east. It says, "Fear not, I'm with you. I'll bring your descendants from the east." It's talking about the east and west in Mesopotamia, in the Middle East. It's not talking about the Philippines. The far east comes from a paraphrase from a later Bible scholar, not from a translation from Isaiah 43:5. So that's just one. So I'd challenge them to say, where's your evidence that you're actually the church that Christ founded? And if you don't have that, why should I take your claim seriously? And go to Catholic.com to get more on Iglesia Ni Cristo. We've got a few articles there about them. So hopefully that'll be helpful to you. Roberto writes, "I was wondering if a couple has a child and they're not married and they don't ever intend on getting married, should the priest baptize the child? In the church's code of canon law, which is the rule book for the Catholic Church, how the church is governed and operates, in canon 868, point 1.2, so it's in canon 868, there's a line, it talks about baptism here, it says, there must be a founded hope that the infant will be brought up in the Catholic religion. So in order to baptize a child, you have to have a founded or a reasonable hope they'll be brought up in the Catholic faith. You don't have to have a promise they'll go to Mass every week. Both parents don't have to be Catholic even. One of them might not be Catholic. They don't have to become Catholic. That parent doesn't even have to promise to raise the child to be Catholic. They just can't inhibit it or, you know, decide that the child's going to be raised in another faith. Now, the reason we have this canon is some people will think, how could the church turn away someone from being baptized? Well, what if you have a couple who are Catholic, but they haven't been to Mass in years? They don't believe in the church anymore. They don't believe in Catholicism. They do a baptism for a social function to please grandma. The child's baptized and then is never brought to Mass again. Now, you know, there's a weighty responsibility for someone who is baptized that they're now a child of God. And if you're not going to take up that responsibility, then you have put them in a not good situation by placing the demands of the gospel on this person by being baptized if you had no intention of raising them in the faith. So that's where this comes from. So I would say, Roberto, in this case, it depends, but I would lean towards probably not. There are people who were not married in the church, or they're unmarried, who have a baby. And maybe they'll say, look, we're going to regularize our marriage later, or we're going to get married later. We just have the baby now. We want to baptize them. In those cases, okay, you're going to raise your child. You need to sort out your life. Then let's baptize this child. But if this person says, I'm never going to get married in the church, and if they have this attitude like they never want to follow what the church teaches, it sounds more like they'd be someone where you don't have that founded hope they're going to raise the child in the Catholic religion, or at least they're going to alter the Catholic religion so much they're not really raising them in it. So that's one where I can't give you a hard and fast answer without knowing the particular case, but if they have no intention of ever getting married, then they have a severe misunderstanding of the faith, and so there may not be that hope the child would be raised to be Catholic, and that's something that the pastor would have to look into. But even if they didn't get married, maybe they could still make a promise like, well, we can't get married. We're not right for each other, but we're going to have joint custody and I'm going to raise this child to be Catholic. Okay. So remember, when it comes down to the situation, canon 868, if the child's going to be baptized, there has to be a founded hope the child will be brought up in the Catholic religion. And that would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis. But if somebody doesn't believe in marriage, doesn't believe in what the church teaches on these major issues, doesn't believe in following the church, that would make me skeptical the child could be baptized. So they'd have to talk to the priest for that particular case. And finally, Coleman. So we got through all of them, all the ones that were posted. Coleman says, I think what would be really helpful would be a roadmap of conversion. It'd be great if we had an optimal order of discussions in terms of Catholic teaching. Any insight would be great. Here I would say you just have to meet the person where they're at. I mean, it'd be great to have that kind of roadmap. Like, what do I introduce people to? really, people are different. I mean, people have, you know, different things they care about that are important to them. Like for me, coming into the church's teaching on salvation was my big thing that helped me come into the faith. For other people, it was the Eucharist or the papacy. Mary was a stumbling block for me. Other people, Mary is what brought them into the faith. Find what the person is most interested in and use that as the roadblock and meet them where they're at too. I mean, if they're an atheist, don't get into a big discussion about whether the Pope is infallible. We got to make sure God exists, Jesus rose from the dead and founded a church before we can cover later issues. So meet them where they're at and then figure out what they care about or what intrigues them the most and try to nurture that as much as you can in your conversation. So great emails, messages, great questions, everyone. Can't wait to do another one of these again. If you want to submit a question for the podcast, go to trenthornpodcast.com, become a subscriber, gold level and up to be able to submit questions. And even if you don't do that, keep tuning into the podcast and you'll hear other answers to learn how to explain and defend our Catholic faith. So thanks so much for being here today and you have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.